The meeting of the Senate Finance Committee will please come to order. It's Wednesday, March 28th, 2012. And our first bill up on the agenda is Senate File 2112, Senator Youngbauer, with the annual claims bill. Good morning, Senator Youngbauer.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. I guess I can say members, right?
There's a couple.
Members, I actually don't have a copy of the actual bill, but it's Senate File 2112. I do have an amendment, but I come before you with the annual claims bill, and that is claims against the state. They're heard in the claims subcommittee, and everything that we'd move before you has been approved in that, heard and approved in the claims subcommittee. So I do have the A1 amendment.
Senator Youngbauer, we're going to have to wait until we establish a quorum before we can adopt that. But if you want to explain a little bit about what's in the claims bill, I noticed it's one of the smallest we've seen in a long time. How many claims did you have to review this year?
About 40 claims. It is one of the small, yes, it's very small compared to what we've seen since I've been a chair there, obviously, as well. And things that need to be reimbursed for Department of Corrections, people that get hurt on sentence to serve, those kind of issues is what we were looking at in the claims bill. And so we did have, I think, only one somewhat significant injury. It's always interesting to read through the claims bill. So if anybody ever gets a chance, just reading through the claims, it's a nice small folder, generally a couple times a year, that's about that thick. And it makes for great fun reading, but probably the worst one that we had this time was a tree had fallen on someone and sentenced to serve, causing back and neck injuries. And so those are the interesting kind of things you hear is different injuries of people getting hurt, both in the Department of Corrections, people that lose property in transferring from one facility to the other. But mostly injury things that we do end up hearing. And so it's reimbursements for those injuries and reimbursements to Department of Corrections for issues that they've already approved. And if somebody questions whether or not that should have been approved but not approved, that comes before the Claims Committee, and we look at those and look at the evidence and then determine whether we believe something was wrongly judged and move those forward.
These are all sentenced to serve claims, it looks like, this year. Is there, you know, are they required to wear gloves? Are they cuts, just sprained ankles? It's broken bones?
Madam Chair and members, we're actually in the process of, we requested some information on different policies in terms of sentenced to serve. They do have different group leaders that go with them. They've got a set of safety protocols, but we had some injuries with chainsaws that we were extremely curious about is who's teaching them to run the chainsaws, what are the protocols, what kind of safety equipment. They're wearing hard hats, safety glasses, those sorts of things. But one of them was Chad Westring we looked at was one of those more extreme incidents. I think Chad was the one that the tree fell on, if I remember right. And we had a lot of questions about how did that happen, who was supervising. And I guess that's just the explanation was sometimes you just can't determine exactly which way the tree is going to fall, and people can't get out of the way. So, but we do, those are the questions. So it's good that you bring that up, Madam Chair, because we do question all those things. As well, when people lose property that are in the Department of Corrections, we do ask for what are the protocols? How do they look at those things? How do the inmates get the same level of protection of their own personal property as we might expect? So we ask all those questions in our committee as we're looking at these claims.
Okay. Senator Youngbauer, I think we'll have your amendment moved. We can't vote on it until we get one more person. And so then you can explain the amendment before we take action. And I believe Senator Olson actually we have to move the A1 and the A3, don't we? Can we
move
the
A3?
We haven't decided. distributed.
Madam Chair, I have Senator Youngbauer. I have the A3.
Oh, okay.
Well, he's already explained the claims.
I have the A1. I don't know.
And that's the one you were just explaining. I was taking that as the base bill, basically.
Yes, the base bill that we first submitted was a bill that we heard over the interim and then had approved, and the A1 amendment is some further items that we had just heard this past Friday morning.
Could you perhaps...
Or Monday morning, I'm sorry. We moved it from Friday to Monday.
Begin with an explanation of the A3. Oh, no, it's not available
mine.
Yet.
So, Madam Chair and members, I'm waiting with bated breath to hear an explanation of the A3.
Thank you.
Madam Chair,
Senator Olson,
is Senator Youngbauer going to explain it, or do you want me to?
Our Senate staff will help explain it.
Okay.
Madam Chair, members, the A3 amendment is an amendment to the claims bill, but it's appropriating money related to 2010 floods in the fall of 2010, September. Reducing an appropriation to the Department of Agriculture that was made in the special session by $285,000 and redirecting that money. $235,000 for additional FEMA match money as an appropriation to the Department of Public Safety. This was a governor's supplemental budget recommendation as a 2012 deficiency for what DPS has available to pay for FEMA match costs. And then line 1.13. Clause C, $50,000 appropriation for the Commissioner of Natural Resources to identify potential flood mitigation measures. So these are both flood-related appropriations, redirecting appropriations from the 2010 flood-related special session.
So, members, this is money that has not been expended from that flood event, had been appropriated, and now we're redirecting it for other purposes where there were deficiencies for also flood events. So it's just moving the money from one area of need to another.
So
Senator Jungbauer?
Madam Chair and to Senate Counsel, then, is this the appropriate vehicle that this language should be on? Because it will not match the House bill then at that point as well.
This is an appropriations bill, and so we thought it would be an appropriate vehicle for it. It's something that has to also get done this year. Senator Perry?
Well, Madam Chair, I'm just I'm somewhat I'm just somewhat concerned because I have huge issues in the city of Owatonna because of the lack of completing programs dollar-wise by Homeland Security and FEMA on public buildings, and we're still having issues getting any funds going that way. One in particular is a huge huge project, which is I'm thinking it's the county shed that was underwater, and I guess I'm just not comfortable throwing money out until if this is for identifying potential flood mitigation. I understand that, but we have cities and counties that still aren't whole that could be benefiting from these dollars if they're just sitting there. I mean, maybe I'm not understanding this, but I'm pretty concerned about this. If there's money to be gone someplace, I think we need to take a look at those communities that were in the middle of the flood that are still having issues collecting any money.
To that, Madam Chair.
Senator Olson.
Following up on that point, the lines 1.6 to 1.12 are for match. In the area designated for flooding in Minnesota, and it's to state agencies and political subdivisions. Can you tell me whether the Owatonna situation, whether it's the state or county facility that's affected, is that included? Would that be eligible within that first clause of this amendment? Could staff help with that?
Is someone from DPS present?
Sure.
They would like to come up.
Madam Chair, members, I do want to say that I'm a bit hesitant. The claims bill does need to go through for those appropriations, and we don't really want to make the claims bill a target for other things and make it controversial. These are issues that need to be taken care of. So unless someone can assure me that this will become non-controversial and not hold up the claims bill, I'm very hesitant on this amendment.
Well, it could be that this is being drafted to take care of some of those needs down in Senator Perry's district.
That's
yet.
Right.
I'm not certain what the request is all for, but it was for unfinished business related to that flood yet. There still is additional money left in the past appropriation, too, that has not been expended. We are not taking all of it.
Madam Chair, was there somebody here that could address that?
I'm not sure if he's prepared for that or not.
Madam Chair and members, I'm Jared Jordahl with the Department of Public Safety. I apologize. I just stepped in the room. Just looking over the amendment. This amendment does match, I believe I heard Brent say correctly that this does match the governor's budget request for $235,000 for the supplemental budget for wrapping up disaster 1900 DR, and this would be the supplemental appropriation that was in the governor's budget.
That's correct. It does match the governor's request. I just am not sure where it is all directed toward.
I guess, Madam Chair and members, is there any way to be certain of this and put this amendment on the floor if we're satisfied that it's – I would have no problem, members, applying this amendment on the floor if I'm sure it's not controversial and something that would jeopardize the claims bill.
I suppose we could wait with it. And I mean, there will likely be another bill with some appropriations in that we could attach it to and get some more information from DPS on.
That would be my preference, Madam Chair and members. And again, you have my promise that if it will not draw controversy and threaten the claims bill, I would be most happy to place it on the bill on the floor of the Senate.
So, Madam Chair?
Senator Olson.
I'm just trying to figure out why you think it would be controversial. You indicated that that there is a fund for this that hasn't been totally utilized. We've never really shied away from trying to help and deal with the flood mitigation, and this is just providing the match, so it's to exercise a drawdown of what we were eligible for federally, but need to have the match for that. I don't know if that $50,000 is controversial or not, but that Zumber River is, you know, a constant challenge, and I think that getting some answers to how you might prevent some of the damage going forward and the costs that go with it is useful as well. But
Senator Youngbaum,
it works both ways. If there's some way or it determined that there's a better vehicle for it, it could come off on the floor too. But generally, I think it's a better opportunity to talk these things through here in the Finance Committee than necessarily on the floor. I can't imagine that you will have trouble with the claims or the flood mitigation aspect of the bill. But
Well, Madam Chair and members, it would still be my preference to not place it on here in the committee. And I'm told that the claims bill has never been used in the past as a vehicle for any other additional appropriations. And I am one of those folks coming from city background as a mayor and stuff, too. I'm very cautious about setting a precedent. Because you start setting that precedent, and I can only imagine some of the other amendments that may try to come on the floor. And this has always been a very non-controversial bill that needs to pass in order to pay these claims against the state. So,
well, Senator Jungbauer, last year I think we did end up adding a few things to the claims bill. But Mr. Gustafson might have a little more explanation.
Madam Chair, members, I just wanted to try to address a little bit of Senator Perry's question. Just to make sure there's understanding of what's in the amendment, the appropriation reduction that is in the amendment is from the fall 2010 floods. It was an appropriation of the Commissioner of Agriculture and referenced Section 12A.04, which has use for livestock investment grants, no-interest disaster recovery loans. It wasn't tied to FEMA match. So there was a grant program established, and we've done that many times when there have been flood-related events. There was a $4 million appropriation to the Department of Agriculture. Much of that money is unused. And so the governor's budget recommendation included money, as Mr. Jordahl noted, to provide matching money when the federal government declares a disaster area and FEMA reimbursement is part of that disaster recovery. State and local governments need to provide matching funds. And the state, as part of our biennial budget, has an appropriation for match. However, knowing or with the uncertainty of any level of disaster, it's unknown what that match need is. And the state has regularly supplemented that appropriation with deficiencies to ensure that enough match is available for a given disaster. And Senator Perry, to your point, Mr. Jordahl could confirm that I know one of the components of FEMA reimbursement is very time-consuming and a very long process, and so it's not surprising to hear that municipality may have outstanding issues in trying to get FEMA reimbursement. But this is attempting to, for those claims and those FEMA declarations, to be able to have sufficient state matching resources in fiscal 12 for DPS to be able to provide for every one of the FEMA dollars that's there the required match amount. So it's taking money from the fall 2010 flood, redirecting it toward a FEMA disaster from the spring of 2010 flooding in an amount that DPS has determined necessary to meet their matching requirements.
Senator Jungbauer.
Madam Chair and members, I'll be clear. I have no problem with the $235,000. It's the issue in C, the $50,000 that DPS is telling me as well. We don't know where that came from, and if that will be a point of controversy, the supplemental budget that the governor requested on the $235,000 is not an issue. That should be very non-controversial.
Well, Senator Jungbauer, we can lay this aside if it's a problem until we get a little further explanation. But it is something that we're going to have to do this session, and we knew this bill would be moving, so we thought it would be an opportunity to package it with yours. So we did have a quorum established, and a few people have stepped back out, but we would like to take action on the A1 amendment at least. So, Senator Olson, can you move the A1 amendment?
I suppose I can.
And this is the bill, basically. It explains what the claims are, and he's putting it on this bill relating to claims against the state relating to corrections. So
again, Madam Chair and members, we had a small claims bill from the interim. The A1 amendment adds on from our meeting we just had on Monday and reviewed the latest claims.
Are there any more questions about that? If not, all in favor of the A1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. The motion does prevail. The amendment is adopted. And was it offered? Was the A3 offered? Do you want to
Well, I'm not.
I don't think it was.
I think we were just discussing it. Because we didn't have a quorum.
Yeah. And so is there anyone who wants to testify for or against 2112? Not? Do members have any further questions? Senator Olson will move that Senate File 2112 be recommended to pass and placed on. As amended and placed on general orders. All in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. The motion does prevail. The bill will be placed on general orders. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
Senator Cruz, welcome. Senator Cruz is going to present House File 2244.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. Thank you for having me, allowing me to present this bill today. As you mentioned, we have House File 2244 as amended by the Senate. So this is our Senate language on here now. I know that you have a tight schedule, so what I would like to do is just very briefly go through the high points of the bill and then move on to the fiscal note, which I believe members have in their packet, give some brief description of the pertinent areas to the Finance Committee, and then have any discussion about it.
Okay, thank you.
Members, House File 2244 has to do with school trust land and management of the school trust land. Many don't know that when our state was founded, when we got the land grant to become a state, we were required by federal law to set aside Section 1 and Section 16 of every township, specifically for the purpose of education and funding education. Over time, these sections have gotten combined, sold, swapped. Essentially right now, a majority of our trust lands are in kind of the northeast part of the state. But this legislation specifically has to do with changing the management of those trust lands, putting in a little bit of accountability features to make sure that these are generating as much revenue as possible for the school children of Minnesota. So I will briefly walk you through the bill at this time. As I mentioned, this bill creates a school trust land advisor and a legislative citizens permanent school fund commission to advise the legislature and the Department of Natural Resources concerning the management of school trust lands. And what I'm going to do is just, as I mentioned, hit the pertinent parts to the committee, not walk you through the entire bill. So in Section 1, that defines the salary for the newly created advisor position. We will touch that again, I believe, in Section 3, so I'm going to move past that. Section 3 has talks about the forest trustland certification. This provides that the forest protection costs will not be certified against the permanent school fund, and that before any costs are certified, they must be presented to the newly created commission, which I will go into more detail on in just a second here. This section also requires the certification report to include a comparison with other public and private forest lands. One of the problems that we're running into, one of the accountability factors here, is that the current certification process that's used simply certifies numbers. It doesn't actually dig deep enough or to figure out if those costs are legitimate or reasonable costs. So this is going to provide a little bit more transparency there. We'll move on to Section 4. This concerns the requirements and reports. This section directs the DNR to choose maximizing the long-term revenue when the goals for school trust lands are in conflict. Essentially, what we're talking about here is we very clearly define that when there is a choice between using these school trust lands for profit or a long-term sustainability that we do need to err on the side of profit here. This is pertinent to the Finance Committee in the fact that we do, in this section, put some definitions to the lands and make some requirements that lands that are non-profit generating do be swapped or sold off. So I'll get into a little bit more detail on that when we talk about the fiscal note here. Next, I'd like to move us on to Section 6. This creates the new Legislative Citizen Permanent School Fund Commission in the legislative branch. This is going to replace the Permanent School Fund Advisory Committee that currently exists. This commission will consist of 16 members, two public members appointed by the Senate, two public members appointed by the House, four public members appointed by the governor, four members of the Senate, including two from the minority party, and four members from the House, including two from the minority party. Public members will serve a four-year staggered term and must have practical experience or demonstrated knowledge in the areas of renewable or non-renewable resource management, development, real estate, business, finance, trust administration, asset management, or the practice of law in any of these areas. In this section, the governor's appointments are also subject to the advice and consent of the Senate. Essentially, I'd like to take you to Section 8 now. The most particular subdivision to the Finance Committee here is Subdivision 3. This speaks to compensation. I have to take a quick leak, but I believe it's a Section 2 salary schedule that we put them on, which would be comparable to the salaries of some of our commissioners. I believe we also include the chair of the Metropolitan Council in this category. So we'll go into just a little bit more detail with that. Why don't I move us on to the fiscal note and kind of talk about the more specific costs here. If I could get the members to turn to page 3 of the fiscal note to begin with. This is probably one of the most significant pieces of the legislation concerning the Finance Committee. In Section 4 of the bill, it states that by July 1st of 2016, the Permanent School Trust Fund must be compensated for all school trust lands, including under a designation of policy provision that prohibits long-term economic return. These are those lands that I was talking about that currently, because of their definition, can't produce profit. We have them set aside as specific wildlife preserves. The costs that are associated with this are estimated to be right around $2 million. $2 billion a year for that. So the area that would affect the Finance Committee here is that as of right now, if these lands just needed to be sold and there were no other swaps or folks to come in and purchase these properties, that would fall back on the general fund here. Now, it's the desire and the hope that these lands would be swapped out for other currently owned state lands so that there would not be a significant cost. It would just simply be a swap. So that's that portion of the bill. If you look on page 4, there are also some very minimal costs that would be incurred by the Department of Natural Resources as they go through and label all of these different lands. You'll find that right at the top, third paragraph on page 4 of the fiscal note. Again, I'd like to point out on page 5 of the fiscal note, it's very specific in the fact that these costs are just estimated costs. And I know, Madam Chair, to be honest, we got this fiscal note about 10 minutes before we gaveled into the committee here, and I know that there's been kind of a concern about the way our fiscal note process is handled, and I hope at some point we look into that, because I definitely think we can do these a little bit more accurately than we're doing them right now. But just to accentuate that fact, like I said, on line 5, it talks about how these impacts aren't known, because you can't decide whether these are going to be land swaps or actual sales. We're assuming in this fiscal note and this $2 billion cost here with the fire suppression that the general fund is going to have to come in and compensate for these lands, because we would not be able to swap them or do that. So that's where this is coming in. As I mentioned, the hope is that we would be able to swap those lands rather than do that. Next, we can go to page 7 of the fiscal note. I'd like to bring you about halfway through the page there, where it says, as the corpus of the permanent school trust fund increases, interest earnings that are allocated to the school districts will increase. They estimate these to be right around $63,000 a year. This is going to be marked on the fiscal note as a plus to the Department of Education.
Senator Cruz, as we review this fiscal note, which we didn't have very much time to do, but it appears that, and this has been the common practice, that in order to manage the lands, they do generate money from the lands, of course, and the expenses are paid for out of the revenue that they bring in. And in fact, this position that is being sought is coming out of the permanent school fund, not out of the general fund. So MMB would be reimbursed for those expenses from revenue from the fund.
Madam Chair and members, that is correct. With that newly created advisor position in MMB, the concern would come here with those land definitions and trying to move some of those non-performing lands into a performing land status. Part of the oversight here is making sure that we are moving some of these lands that are currently not able to do anything with them, because they're in areas like the boundary waters where we don't have any options with them. They're kind of locked up. This legislation would direct the Department of Natural Resources to within a certain time frame to swap those lands out or purchase those lands, and that's where the cost would come in. And that, and also that fire suppression piece. Right now we are charging the school trust lands with fire suppression. Now if you look at any of our state parks, if you look at any of our county parks, our city parks, no other land like this gets charged for fire suppression. Only the school trust lands. So essentially we're moving that out. We're saying that is not a viable cost to certify against those profits. So that money would have to come from somewhere else. It would have to come from the Department of Natural Resources, or it would have to come out of the general fund. And that's where we were estimating that at right around $2 billion. That's what the estimate was. And then the only other cost, you're right, the MMB cost for this new advisor position would be a cost that would be certified against the profits of the school trust land. And then the only other cost that would be associated with this legislation would be that of this newly created commission. When you talk about the per diem of the public participants and also the legislators for that commission, essentially that would be the same as the commission that currently exists. And actually, I think with that, Madam, those costs are those costs are shown on page 9 and page 10 of the fiscal note. And I think with that, that should be everything, and I'll stand for any other questions.
Are there questions from members? Is someone here from the DNR who might want to testify on the bill?
Madam Chair, members, Bob Meyer, Department of Natural Resources. First of all, we'd like to say thank you to Senator Cruz for working with us on this issue. We do support this version of the bill. We have a couple issues that we need to work with the author on as we continue moving forward, but I'm sure we can get those done. I think the couple of things on the fiscal note, the fire costs, the five-year average is $2 million per year that have been charged to the trust. And as Senator Cruz said, trust fund lands are the only lands that are assessed firefighting costs. So this $2 million would not be certified against the trust. Rather, it would push those costs into the general fund. The DNR does have an open appropriation for firefighting. That will be something we'll have to deal with in the out years. Also, the bill does require the DNR to identify lands that are not generating revenue and then compensate the trust for that. We estimate that right now the land value would be about $63 million. So the bill does require that to be done by 2016. So we will be working with the legislature to receive appropriations to buy out those lands or exchange them and get them back to the trust, get those dollars into the trust. And there is a cost that needs to be done with that, dealing with appraisals and title work, and we'll be working with the legislature in future years to get appropriations for those activities as well.
Senator Cruz?
And Madam Chair and members, just to that point, I would like to make it apparent that it's the desire of the author that rather than just appropriate dollars and purchase those lands outright, putting that revenue into the fund, that we would focus on land swaps for lands that can produce. I just personally feel like that is a more long-term, sustainable benefit for the trust lands. So I guess I would just like to get it on record that I think that's probably the better way to go, and I hope that as the Department of Natural Resources does that they will focus on that land swap.
Thank you. Mr. Meyer, the DNR is working on a federal land swap with I don't know how many acres. I don't recall how many it is, but can you give us a little information on that right now?
Yes, Madam Chair, members, the land exchange you're talking about is with the Boundary Waters Canoe Area, and actually you passed some legislation in Senator Carlson's land bill that sets up the legal framework for us to do that exchange. Currently, there's about 85,000 acres of trust fund land within the Boundary Waters Canoe Area that are bound from any revenue generation whatsoever because of the restrictions within the park. We're working with the federal U.S. Forest Service to identify lands. Right now, the proposal from the Trust Fund Advisory Committee is a hybrid model of exchange and buyout. It would be about $100 million of cash from the federal government and roughly 35,000 acres of land in exchange. We're working closely with the U.S. Forest Service to identify those lands. We need to receive a federal congressional approval and a congressional appropriation, obviously, for the buyout dollars, but also there's a environmental review process that we need to go through to the NEPA process, it's called, National Environmental Protection Act. We're asking Congress for an expedited fashion of that review to occur so we can get this done in an expeditious manner. Commissioner Landwehr and myself are closely working with our congressional delegation to make sure that it does receive the support it needs. However, it does face some challenges in D.C., as many other issues do at this point in time.
Does anyone else want to testify for or against the bill?
Mm-hmm.
I know, Senator Cruz, you've been working this out for some time, trying to bring people to a compromise. Certainly, we appreciate that effort, because I sit on the School and Trust Advisory Council right now, and we've been having a great deal of discussion in the last year and a half. Before that, I don't know that the council was really active, but there's been a lot of interest recently, and a lot of this is kind of evolving from some of the testimony that has been taken in those hearings, and the need to try to increase the revenue from the lands that we have. It was interesting to note we had a speaker in from Utah, and found out that they have set up, you know, someone in a separate office, actually have a separate office that oversees the trust lands, and they are really generating revenue. It's amazing how they have accelerated their opportunities for revenue in that state. And so we're certainly hoping that we can pick up the speed, so to speak, We may have some very valuable resources. We've always had timber, and they've harvested that. But there may be some valuable mineral resources too, and we have to find out more about it. And focusing in on what might be out there is going to be very important.
Well, Madam Chair, I'll even do you one better. When you're right, as we had the folks from Utah in, they gave us some great examples of even revenue generating ideas that had nothing to do with the actual natural resources. They had done some phenomenal things with real estate development, with their park areas and entertainment, that they were able to commingle profit generating tasks with the environment and didn't tax any of those natural resources at all, allowed them to stay completely renewable. So there was some great ideas, and I hope that's the direction that this bill takes us. Like I said, a little bit more accountability, kind of maybe gently guiding the Department of Natural Resources, who continues to oversee those trust lands in this legislation, in that direction, that we do focus on what we call, a lot of people don't understand this as well, we have a fiduciary obligation. And as you know, Madam Chair, that fiduciary is a very tight legal term. It has some consequences with it. And we as a state, we as the legislature, as the commissioner of natural resources, as the governor, have that fiduciary obligation under trust law to make sure that these lands are generating profit. And I would humbly say that we can do better. We can do better.
I believe so too, Senator Cruz. Are there any other questions about the bill? If not, Senator Hahn.
Madam Chair, I'd be happy to recommend that House File 2244 be recommended pass and referred to the floor.
It has to go to the Rules Committee because it names the legislators to a commission.
All right.
But Senator Cruz, if we're careful, if we're really speedy, we can get the report to the floor. The Rules Committee is meeting this afternoon, so maybe we can get it on the agenda yet. So on Senator Hahn's motion that House File 2244 be recommended to pass and be sent to the Rules Committee, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. The motion does prevail. Senate File 2244 will be moved to the Rules Committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Next up, we're going to have Senate File 2172. Senator Howe, welcome to our committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate File 2172 is a bill that will ensure that that the money appropriated to counties and municipalities for road projects will continue regardless of what happens with our budgeting process here. I serve as the Vice Chair of the Transportation Department. And 99% of our transportation funding is dedicated funding, has nothing to do with the general fund issue. And as you know, we have several road projects that were delayed last year, and we've got several claims that we are paying and that MnDOT is having to pay for projects that were delayed that contractors are filed. So this is an effort to ensure that at least at the county level, on municipal state aid roads and county state aid roads, that their projects can continue regardless of the discussion up here. And what we're trying to do is ensure that that the taxpayers don't have an additional burden and that transportation issues and safety issues don't get used as a pawn in some negotiation that has nothing to do with transportation. And with that, Madam Chair, I do have a couple of testifiers here today.
Thank you, Senator Howe. Would you identify yourself, please, for the record?
Yes, Madam Chair. My name is Lee Gustafson. I'm the city engineer for the City of Minnetonka. I'm also currently on the Legislative Committee for the City Engineers Association, and I'm also currently Vice President of the Minnesota Public Works Association. So on behalf of the City of Minnetonka and those associations, I want to thank you for allowing me to speak today. I'm not going to bore you with construction details, but maybe try to give you a different side of a shutdown situation within the city of Minnetonka. Last year, we were in the process of reconstructing MnDOT interchange on Highway 169. The interchange is more commonly referred to as the Bren Road interchange or the Opus Area interchange. The Opus Area, if you don't know, employs about 13 to 14,000 people. The reason this interchange was being replaced, that was currently under capacity for the current uses in that area and severely under capacity for the future uses that are proposed in that area. The project was developed as a public-private partnership with area businesses. The interchange is also the main gateway into this Opus Area and for the Edina businesses on the east side of 169. The high importance of this access point for the area businesses required this interchange to be replaced in the quickest time frame possible. The project did take us several years to develop. As a part of the process, the City of Minnetonka assured area businesses that we would do everything within reason to minimize impacts to their businesses. Some of the key components of our, I'll call it our business plan, but it's also part of our construction plans, was that the bridge was only to be out of service for a maximum of 90 days. We did offer a $10,000 per day incentive to get the bridge open ahead of the 90-day schedule, and also a $10,000 per day penalty if it did not open within 90 days. We also included specific construction phasing schedules within the plans that ensured good access to both sides of the highway, especially when the bridge was down. In preparation for the construction, many businesses also worked with the City of Minnetonka to modify their schedules and deliveries to coincide with our work plan. Several businesses also had special events and advertising planned to coincide with special construction phasing to kind of make fun of the construction but also increase their business revenue. To say the area businesses were counting on our contractor to adhere to these construction plans, schedules, and specs would be an understatement. The shutdown, unfortunately, disrupted all these preparations to minimize impacts to area businesses. It also left many businesses in a state of disarray, not knowing if the project was going to be completed, and in our case, if the project was actually going to be done and the bridge was going to be open prior to winter setting in. In order to address the impacts from the shutdown, we spent many hours and, frankly, many weeks and a lot of money trying to figure out how we could change our construction schedule to have any hopes of completing the project before the winter. With this as a main goal, we determined it was necessary to significantly condense the schedule and change the construction phasing, which changed all these components we had in to minimize impacts to area businesses. Although we did have a contractor very willing to work with us, we still have a significant amount of shutdown claims hanging over our heads. That's the City of Minnetonka's responsibility. We also are currently spending way too much time and money working with our consultants trying to negotiate with the contractor, figuring out what claims are legitimate. More importantly, the money that we're going to have to spend on shutdown claims, we don't have in our budget right now, so we're going to have to figure out through the Minnetonka taxpayers how we're going to have to pay those shutdown claims. The one bright spot is we did get the bridge completed last year, and so we're not too far behind schedule. However, we are responsible, as I mentioned, for hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of shutdown claims. And the business will still have impacts this upcoming construction season because we're, frankly, behind schedule a little bit. Just a quick summary of the reasons we feel that this legislation should be reported. As mentioned, the transportation funding is constitutionally dedicated. Funding for the project is typically in place months, if not years, before a construction project begins. And frankly, because it takes that long to bring a plan like this to get it ready. Construction contracts and expectations are also in place months before a project begins. Area businesses, contractors, both large and small, and consultants use these contracts and dedicated funding sources as an indication of how to plan their workload and schedules. Lastly, employees of these companies plan on these contracts, frankly, to make everyday decisions that affect their families. I'm hopeful that this brief summary that I provided will help you provide why this legislation should be supported, and I'd be more than happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Thank you, Mr. Gustafson. Does anyone have any questions?
Madam Chair.
Senator Howell.
Madam Chair, I think that we had a handout, and I'm just going to briefly paraphrase or read portions of a statement here from Mr. Wayne Sandberg. He is the Washington County Engineer.
You can paraphrase it if you'd like, Senator Howell.
And I'll just read a couple of a paragraph here of his. The money intended to be the money this bill intends to address is constitutionally dedicated through the Highway Users Tax Distribution Fund to local agencies. This is not general fund money. This money cannot be spent anywhere else, and keeping these dollars flowing to locals so they can carry out their mission is the goal. Additionally, making sure we keep our local funding sources available ensures we have the resources to meet our requirements for other funds we may have, for example, federal transportation dollars. This is important because when it comes to construction, our window in Minnesota is a small one. Every working day we have counts. When we start a construction project, we have made a promise to the residents and businesses of the community that we are going to build the needed infrastructure improvements to support the quality of life, the economic vitality that every citizen wants as quickly and as with as little impact as possible. Once construction project starts, there is no going back. This bill helps us keep these projects moving forward and keep that promise. And I have one additional testifier just has a couple of sentences to say.
Okay, thank you. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Abby Breidick. I'm with the Association of Minnesota Counties, and Wayne Sandberg really wanted to be here today, but because of the fluid nature of the schedule, of course, that's how it goes. I just wanted to point out, you know, there are a lot of contingent appropriations bills that are out there this year, and because the state does so many important things, it's detrimental when it shuts down. But I just wanted to impress upon you the different nature of this kind of bill, because these funds are constitutionally dedicated, and often there is, you know, one or two people who may shut down a project if we can't get materials testing from MnDOT or if there's no one to process payroll for those folks. So this isn't, this is just of a different nature, and I hope that you can consider it so when you are considering this legislation. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Breidick. And that's what we have in considering bills like this that are not affecting the general fund or have other sources of revenue that are non-general fund. And we have passed several of them already in this committee, and this fits that description as well. So are there any questions? Is there anyone who wants to testify for or against the bill in the audience?
Madam Chair, I'll make whatever motion is appropriate.
Senator Fischbach moves that Senate File 2172 be recommended to pass and be placed on general orders. All in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. The motion does prevail. The bill will be placed on general orders.
Thank you very much.
We're going to next take Senate File 1734, Senator Gazelka. Welcome, Senator Gazelka.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
If you would like to start out by explaining your bill for us.
Madam Chair, this is an initiative between the Collision Repair Shops, the Insurance Federation. They've got the DPS on board, and the auto dealers are not opposed to it. But, Madam Chair, I believe there's an oral amendment that, if offered, will take away the fiscal note and the need to even be before this committee.
We like it when you take care of those issues. It's too bad it couldn't have been done sooner. It would have saved you a stop. Senator Fischbach.
Madam Chair, I do have, I get page one. I do have an amendment I'd like to offer. Page one, line 11. We're going to remove, reinstate the stricken 5,000 and delete the 9,000.
That's right.
Yep, that's correct.
Are there any questions about that motion? If not, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. The motion does prevail. The amendment is adopted. Senator Gazelka.
Madam Chair, if you want testimony from Bob Johnson from the Insurance Federation, he can. Kevin Wally is somewhere in the building, but I know that there is agreement on this bill. And
Madam Chair.
Senator Fischbach.
Given that we've removed any fiscal issue, I would just make the appropriate motion to move it on unless there are questions. But if we've removed any fiscal issue, we might just want to move it along.
Just a brief review of what the bill does, please.
Sure. Madam Chair and committee members, Bob Johnson, Insurance Federation of Minnesota. Just briefly, committee members, this is an initiative, as Senator Gazelka had said, it's a result of about 18 months of discussions between the collision repair shops and the insurance industry. And with the change now, what's in the bill is a modification of the current statutory standard for when a vehicle is totaled. Today there is a 70% standard of the actual cash value, but excluded from that 70% is the cost of passive restraint system airbag repairs. The bill will move it to 80%, but it'll eliminate that exclusion. So it's an easier application of the standard, and all of the impacted industries agree with this easier application of that standard. There's also a paragraph or an amendment in section 4 of the bill that changes a reporting time frame from auto insurers to DPS from a current within 48 hours standard to a within 10 days, and we've met with the agency. It's more in accord and more realistic in terms of reporting that information to the agency. With that, Madam Chair, the rest of the changes are just conforming changes to those two changes. There's no other substantive law change in the bill.
Are there any questions? If not, Senator Fischbach moves that Senate File 1734 be recommended to pass and as amended and placed on general orders. All in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. All opposed, nay. The motion does prevail. Senate File 1734 will be placed on general orders.
Thank you,
Senator Gazelka. And we see Senator Gerlach is here now, so we'll go back to Senate File 2186.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. Now that capital investment just adjourned, I'm sure you'll have new members flooding in here.
I'm sure we will.
Members, I have Senate File 2186 before you, and this deals with the buyer's card for off-sale liquor licenses. And I have an amendment, the A2 amendment as well, which is nothing changes in the concept of the A2 amendment. It's just that it was drafted to the wrong section of law previously, and the interested parties have gotten together and figured out the precise way this is supposed to be done. And so the A2 amendment is just simply the correct drafting of this concept.
Senator Magnus? Will you move the A2 amendment?
I will. As soon as I see it. But I will, Madam Chair. Thank you.
So this amendment is more of a technical change than what was originally in the bill?
That's correct, Madam Chair.
Chair, I'll move the amendment then. Yep.
Any questions from members? If not, Senator Higgins?
On the original, there was an effective date, and on the amendment, there isn't. Do we need the effective date?
Otherwise, it reverts to August 1st. August 1st is fine. It shouldn't be a problem with this particular bill.
Sure, it shouldn't be.
So if there's no further questions on the amendment, all in favor of Senator Magnus's motion, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. The motion does prevail. The amendment is adopted. Senator Gerlach.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Then working off the A2 amendment, what the situation here is that liquor stores are required to, of course, be licensed, and when a wholesaler delivers product to them, the liquor store needs to prove that they are, in fact, licensed. So the administrative mechanism is that they have a buyer's card. They're able to show the driver, and the delivery is made. Well, these buyer's cards, of course, prove that you are a licensed realtor, and if those are retailer, I should say.
retailer.
If those, too used to talking about licensed realtors in the Commerce Committee, but the retailer. And those cards, of course, have expiration dates, and what happened in previous shutdown is that those expired. Of course, these establishments were still licensed, but yet they didn't have the card, and it was bringing things to a halt. And the purpose of this bill is to solve that problem, because we ought not hold these private businesses subject to shutdown or can't offer product to their customers because of the politics of what goes on here in St. Paul. So that's simply this bill simply allows that buyer's card to be, it says, deemed sufficient to allow purchase until the state is able to issue the necessary permit. That's simply the bill.
Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair and Senator Gerlach, you have this isn't a shutdown specific amendment or bill, I guess it is now. Would there be other situations in which a license has been issued but the permit hasn't been issued that would come into play?
Senator Gerlach.
Madam Chair, I can't really conceive of one in anyone. That would be the only example of what has happened, but I would imagine even a natural disaster would, if it's going to affect a state licensing or, I mean, a permitting agency would, probably there'd be bigger problems to deal with, I guess I would say. So, no, this doesn't specifically say about shutdown, but it does just say in the event that they cannot issue them, that once they're up and running and they can issue it, then they'll do it. But you still get to use your buyer's card in that interim period of time.
And Senator Gerlach, excuse me, but if there were a strike, I imagine something like that could impact this as well if the workers weren't there to process these.
And
Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair and Senator Gerlach, I read somewhere in some newspaper or somewhere that whoever authored this bill would be the most popular legislator in the state. So,
and he's retiring.
Cash in on that popularity.
Is there anyone who wanted to testify for or against the bill? If there's no other questions, then Senator Magnus will move that Senate File 2186, as amended, be recommended to be passed and be placed on general orders. All in favor of that amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. The motion does prevail. The bill will be placed on general orders.
Thank you.
Our next bill up is Senate File 1719, Senator Hoffman.
Madam Chair, members,
welcome, good morning. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you. Before you today, we have Senate File 1719, and what this bill does is it establishes a motorcycle road guard certificate. And what brings us before you today is we had a fiscal note on it, and we've worked with the stakeholders and the department, and I think we've got that problem solved. But we do have an amendment, Madam Chair, the A2 amendment. If somebody would like to help me with that.
I'll move the amendment, Madam Chair.
We have it. Senator Magnus moves the A2 amendment. Could you explain the amendment, please?
I'm going to defer to my testifier. They just got it, and I haven't even actually had a chance to look at it yet. So,
welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Valerie Jarek, and I'm here today representing the association called Abate, the American Bikers for Awareness, Training, and Education. It's the largest bikers training group in the state, 4,000 members. And the amendment, what the amendment does is it amends the bill. This bill is a road guarding bill. What has happened in the past, and I don't know if you want to get into too much detail, but briefly, when there's organized rides for charity, for veterans or whatever, and they're traveling through communities, they typically notify the city that they're coming through so that public safety police are aware of it. But what happens is when they are planning to come to a certain crossing at a certain time, the police haven't always been able to be there. They get called out on other calls. They're busy. They don't have enough staff on board right at the time. So the cyclists have been flagging those intersections themselves, and that's not legal for them to do that. So this establishes a training program. The rules will be written by the Department of Public Safety, and the training, it will be done through the Motorcycle Training Association that is run through MNSCU. So every flagger would now be a certified flagger under rules developed by the Department of Public Safety, making them legal to flag when it's appropriate. these are organized rides, so they will. What this does is the cities of the first class testified in an earlier committee in the Senate that they had problems and wanted to be an exempt from just allowing anyone to come through and flag, or these certified flaggers. They wanted to have an opportunity to look at it and decide if they wanted flaggers or if they wanted to have their own people do it. We put an amendment in the bill. We're taking that out now because that was too onerous for them, and the cities then association came forward and said they would like to have us notify all cities, which we believe is probably done now, but we're willing to go along with making sure that if a ride is going through a city, they are notified ahead of time, and if it's a city of the first class, they will have to get consent from the police so that they get the appropriate route to go through.
Does everyone understand the amendment? So the cities will be involved. We did receive a letter that was just handed out that expressed concerns about this, and this amendment addresses those concerns, I believe. Is there anyone here who wanted to testify on this particular amendment? If not, Senator Fischbach. Senator Fischbach moves the A2 amendment. All in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. The motion does prevail. The amendment is adopted. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So what brings us before you today then was the fiscal note, which had a $20,000 bill in fiscal 13 and 10 and 14 and 4 and 15. And so with working with the department and the stakeholders, the department has now, I see in about the middle of the page on page 2, the cost of the rulemaking is what the fiscal note was caused by. And so the rulemaking will be reimbursed from the Motorcycle Safety Fund. And so I believe that that should solve the issue with our fiscal note that brought us here.
And so there was ample funds within that fund that they didn't have a problem taking that out. Is that correct, Senator Hoffman?
Well, I would say that would be true because they put it in their fiscal note. So I don't know if they're here and want to testify. They've been at every other committee we've been at. So
okay. Ms. McCormick.
Yes.
Welcome, Ms. McCormick.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, Pat McCormick, the Director of Driver and Vehicle Services. And I also, Donna Berger is here, and she can introduce herself because it impacts both divisions within the Department of Public Safety.
Good morning, Madam Chair. My name is Donna Berger. I'm the Director of the Office of Traffic Safety with the Department of Public Safety.
Welcome.
Well, Madam Chair and members of the committee, right now, the Division of Driver and Vehicle Services has an interagency agreement with the Office of Traffic Safety to be able to work with them on the motorcycle training that we do for the instructors that instruct in motorcycle safety throughout the state. And so, and there is a statute that allows for the education program and for us to be able to work together. It's Minnesota Statute 121A.36. And so we have an interagency agreement that we annually agree to and have in place. And so because of the fact that the fees won't be charged for this program until we already have the rules done, what we would do is arrange for the funding for the rules through this interagency agreement, and then when the fees are collected, those fees would go back into the motorcycle safety account. And so we believe because of that, we would still be able to have the funding that we need for the rulemaking. And in terms of the rulemaking, when we say $20,000, we're identifying what we believe would be the highest cost for the rulemaking. Obviously, if we don't have to go to hearing on the rules, the cost may be quite a bit less, about $2,000 or something like that. But yes, if we have to go to where we have public hearings and we work with a law judge, then we would certainly have to have more funding for it. So we believe we can handle it through this interagency agreement. And so it would still be within the funding within the department and with each of our divisions.
Hey, are there any questions about the fiscal note? It sounds like you've worked out an arrangement that will work. So glad to hear that, because I know we have that fiscal note out there for a while, and it seems appropriate that the Motorcycle Safety Fund would take care of it, because this is an issue that will affect motorcycle riders as they enjoy these rides that they participate in. If there's no other questions about the bill, anyone else who would want to testify in the audience? Senator Magnus?
Yep. Madam Chair, I'll move Senate File 1719 to be placed on general orders.
Senator Cohen?
Madam Chair, before we go on the motion, let me just ask a couple of questions. Madam Chair, Senator Hoffman, there's a letter that just showed up dated today, I guess, from the County Engineers Association.
Senator Cohen,
yes.
I think you may have missed this. The amendment that was put on.
Okay, does that?
We believe satisfies that. It requires them to notify all the cities prior to the
Madam Chair, and I heard that discussion, so that's what I just wanted to confirm, that with the amendment, as far as you know, is there any objection from cities, counties, police departments, sheriff's departments, or law enforcement?
Someone may be here to respond to that.
Madam Chair, members, as far as the letter from the County Attorney or Engineers Association, we didn't receive this in my office till 7 o'clock last night. So this morning was really the first time that they've voiced an objection to this. But I also have a letter, and I don't know if it was in your packets or not. It was in previous committees. But I have a letter from my own county engineer who's actually in support of the bill. So I believe the amendment should allay some of the concerns that are in the Engineers Association, but I can't speak for them. So it came in at the last minute, so I haven't had a chance to work with them. This is the first I've heard from them.
Did you want to address that issue?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Abby Breidick with the Association of Minnesota Counties. The County Engineer Association is an affiliate group of ours. And, yes, we do apologize for this. The group flagged this as an issue for them to me quite late in the process. So, but while we do appreciate the amendment, the engineers' concerns are sort of more fundamental based on the policy behind the bill, that they don't like that anyone other than law enforcement has the authority to direct traffic on their roads. And so, whether or not there's really any tweaks that could be made to allay those concerns may not be the case. The National County Engineers Association and NCITE has also been lately alerted to the bill, and they do not support it. They sent a letter to the transportation chairs just recently. But, yes, I admit this was late notice, so we haven't had a chance to discuss, so I apologize for that. And but just for the record, that's the position of the county engineers.
Ms. Breidick, when you say that they don't want others than law enforcement to be involved in traffic control, it's my understanding that school safety patrols even help conduct traffic to a certain degree, and not in a much different capacity than they will be doing here. This is to let motorcycle riders through. The school safety patrol lets the children walk through, wherever there's busy streets. And so I don't know that it hasn't had some precedent.
Madam Chair.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would like to also let the committee know that this idea was brought to me by my county sheriff. They, especially out in rural Minnesota, as many of you may know, if you've been in my office, I do ride a Harley. Well, I ride on the back of one. And I've been on these rides. And I have seen where we're taking county resources away to move these motorcycles through. I was on a ride where there's 1,500 motorcycles. And that takes a lot of resources. So the county sheriff, and along with the precedent that you just spoke about, is these people will be trained. And they feel that this will be adequate safety for both the motorcycle riders and the people on the road. And If you are on a ride and let's say that the sheriff or the law enforcement gets called away, then you've got nobody guarding the roads. And then you're kind of skirting traffic. And I've been on those in those situations. So I appreciate the late notice of the letter. I appreciate their concerns. But when my own county engineer and my county sheriff bring it to me, I feel like they would be the people that would know, especially in rural Minnesota where many of these rides go on, would know and trust the people that will be doing this. They will be trained. We're not just sticking anybody out there. So I appreciate the letter. I appreciate their concerns. But I do think that we have a precedent that has already been set, and I would ask the committee to consider that.
Madam Chair. Senator Cohen.
Well,
Madam Chair, Sir Hoffman then makes my point, or at least my question, and I think, Madam Chair, with all due respect, kind of negates your analogy to a few kids who are there allowing kids to cross at the street next to their school or something, because Senator Hoffman mentions a ride of 1,500 bikes, and so that's why I'm wondering if we have, I think I'm going to ask this in Senator Perry's committee, but whether or not we have any position on the part of sheriffs, police, cities, counties, in terms of law enforcement or other broader organizations, not a, a single rural county or county engineer. Ms. Haney seems to have something to offer.
Ms. Haney.
Madam Chair, Senator Cohen, I'm Kathy Haney. I'm a lawyer at Fagery, Baker & Daniels, and we represent the Minnesota Chiefs of Police Association. I very much appreciate Senator Hoffman and the advocates working with us. The amendment is one that we negotiated with them. We had originally opposed the bill as it was first introduced, and now we are neutral on the bill because the amendment does give us notice and give us an ability to interact and and know when these groups are coming through and then make a decision on whether or not we're comfortable, based on other activities in our cities mostly, in terms of using the trained flaggers. I know that our many of our police departments do use volunteer flaggers. They probably have some training, but we do use volunteer flaggers, and there are plenty of times when we don't have sufficient personnel to help them out for motorcycle rides. So, I think, while we're neutral on the bill at this point and not able to say we support it, I think with the amendment that we're comfortable with where we're at.
And
I, one more thing, I apologize.
Sonny.
I do know that the sheriffs have either been, they have not been opposed to it, the Sheriff's Association.
Senator Cohen, any other questions?
That was my question, Madam Chair.
Okay. Ms. Jerick?
Yes, I would just add, Madam Chair and members, Senator Cohen, we did also meet with a member of the Highway Patrol Association. He was here earlier. I don't know if he's here now. And tried to work this all out with all of them, and they were okay with the bill.
Madam Chair? I just want to make another point. When I talked about the 15, that's a uniquely large ride. That's a Ronald McDonald ride, and that's a large ride. I think that most of these rides are smaller. The other thing I would say is these rides are confined to just a certain time of the year in Minnesota where children are walking across the street every single day. So I think that public safety is at the forefront here, and that's why we brought this forward, so we would be sure that we'd have adequate safety for the people on the road. So,
thank you. Senator Magnus. Will move that Senate File 1719 be recommended to pass as amended. There's no further discussion. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed?
No.
Nay. The motion does prevail. The bill will be placed on general orders.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank
you.
We have one more bill. We'd really like to get through it because we had told you if we didn't get through it, we'd want to come back after session, and we really don't want to do that. And so if Senator Gimsey is here, we would like to take up his bill. Welcome, Senator Gimsey.
I bet. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Senate File 2321 is what we like to call our Transportation Policy Omnibus Bill Number 2. What this is measures that went through the committee this year that we compiled into again an omnibus bill, and some of the sections have some fiscal impacts. The vast majority of them are on special revenue funds and trunk highway funds. But I'll have Ms. Boyd go through the impacts and clear for you.
Ms. Boyd.
Madam Chair and committee members, I believe you're being handed this one-page tracking sheet right now. We can just go through that quickly. Some of these we've already heard before this committee, so I'll just be as brief as I can. Starting at the top on line one of the tracking sheet, we had Senate File 1140, which was motor vehicle license plate placement, Senator Perry provision. I believe that was heard on the floor yesterday as well, but that was just a savings to the court's budget, general fund, $14,000 a year. The next one is construction manager and general contractor contracts. This was the cost of developing and implementing the program. That would be a one-time cost of roughly $500,000 from the Trunk Highway Fund in fiscal year 13. The next bill is 1698, which has a number of provisions with different fiscal impact. The first would be changing rulemaking processes for the state aid program, and that would be a savings, because you're eliminating several steps in the process, savings to Trunk Highway, county state aid, and municipal state aid funds of just several thousand a year. The next impact of that bill would be the development of a water permitting process report. That's a joint effort between MnDOT and several other agencies, including PCA. So you see costs from the Trunk Highway Fund and the Environmental Fund. Those are representing staff costs in 1 year of developing that report. The next is 1719, which we just heard, and as you know, that's costs of training and also costs of rulemaking in fiscal year 13, and those are all out of special revenue funds. Some of those are offset in the revenue section below from tuition from the training programs. Senate File 1960, which we also heard in finance, I believe, last week, was the Freight Rail Economic Development Study. And that's a study between MnDOT and DEED to supplement the statewide rail plan and look at the economic development aspects of freight rail specifically. That would be a cost of $216,000. We did put a limit on that, $216,000 expenditure from the rail service improvement account. So that's a special revenue fund. Senate File 2131, provisions of that are in the bill for the design build program modifications for state aid programs. So all that is an elimination of one report in fiscal year 2013, so that's a savings to the county state aid highway fund of doing that report. The last is an amendment that was put on the bill in taxes yesterday, and that is allowing for overweight permits for the transport of farm supplies. MnDOT, in preliminary estimates, estimates that'll be roughly 200 vehicles a year, and that's a $300 permit, annual permit. So that'll be additional revenue to the Trunk Highway Fund of $60,000 a year. So moving down to revenues, we have the last provision of Senate File 1698 was changing the distribution of revenues from these permits on forest hauling forest products and special farm products. These used to be deposited in the bridge signing and inspection account in the special revenue fund. And in 2013 for forest products and 2012 for farm products, I believe, the revenues were shifted to the Trunk Highway Fund. So this provision would shift them back to the bridge inspection and signing account in special revenue. So it's you see the offset to the special revenue and from Trunk Highway. Skip 1719, we've talked about that. 2251. Is the bill dealing with changing rates for state patrol escorts? Some of them went up, some of them went down, but it will be a net increase in revenue to that fund of $125,000 a year, and it's designed to actually match the cost of providing those escorts. And then the last provision was also amended to the bill in taxes yesterday, and this is a gas tax exemption for certain health providers. This would be additional refunds. And this would be a hit to the Highway User Tax Distribution Fund. So what I've shown on the spreadsheet is the sort of pass-through effect of that, because those funds, of course, are dedicated to Trunk Highway and state aid funds. And you can see the impacts there from those refunds.
Ms. Boyd, which health providers are getting this break?
The ambulance?
You may have received the revenue note on this, which I have here. Yes. They are their health providers. So I'm looking for the exact language, and I don't have it in front of me. Here we go. So they're providers of transportation to recipients of medical assistance, home and community-based services. These are people enrolled in certain programs, day programs, adult daycare, treatment and rehabilitation, pre-vocational services, et cetera. And then there's three vehicles they estimate will be also eligible for the refunds that provide that are mobile medical units for the provision of medical or dental services by federally qualified health centers. So these are all health providers.
Are these all private providers that contract to haul people who are on medical assistance or have waivers? And is there any requirement that they reduce their rates because of the break? Or why are we doing this?
Thanks a lot. Madam Chair and members, these are organizations that receive federal and state funds to operate these special daycare facilities and providers for these adult daycare services, training services. And these are vehicles that typically they own, they do own them. They're like vans that haul folks around. And what happens here, just so I can clarify, when they purchase gasoline or diesel fuel to operate those vans and buses, they keep track of the gallons that they purchase, and at the end of the year, they have been in the past eligible for a gas tax exemption. They compile the amount of gas tax that they have paid in during the year, and then they apply for a refund of that gas tax. A new interpretation by the Department of Revenue, I believe, has determined that because they aren't specifically exempted in the law, that they are not eligible for that gas tax refund. And what we're trying to do is continue the practice that they've had in the past and offer this or allow them to take that exemption throughout the year. I know that a large portion of this looks like it's a reduction in the Trunk Highway Fund because of that, but the revenue analysis is projecting that with the change that DOR has made, that they will begin to collect that, but they in the past haven't received it. So they're looking at it as revenue that will be coming in rather than if we do this, it basically stays flat. We haven't been getting that revenue in the past. With this exemption, we will continue not to get the revenue, so it really isn't a direct impact to the Trunk Highway Fund.
Well, in a way, you were getting it, but you were reimbursing it. And is there any expectation that if people don't have to ask for reimbursement, it's just like the old rebate system that the stores use, that oftentimes you just kind of forget about asking for the rebate? If you have to send it in later, could it have any more of an impact, or do they believe that pretty much everyone who is eligible now sends in their request for refunds?
The way the revenue forecast here is that it looks like they've taken into account everybody would apply for the refund, but it would be at their discretion whether they apply for it or not. But in some cases, it has a very significant impact on an industry, and I see Mr. Goodnow is here to talk about that if the committee would like, but on providers of these services who are already under a lot of pressure, in the case of one entity in Candiota County, it's about $1,800 a year that they receive back. That if we don't do this, it will be an $1,800 per year additional expense to them. So we want to do all we can. We haven't been getting the revenue, so we don't have any expectations for it. We just want to continue this and allow them to receive those refunds.
Okay, Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Does this apply just for state funds, or do they also get the rebate of federal gas tax?
I don't think so. Just state. I'm being informed that it's just the state.
The state and also, Madam Chair and Senator Gimsey, is there any auditing done of this? Because I would think that, you know, if there's something that people can figure out how to do that, whether it's the use of the vehicle for other than the intended purpose or whatever, I would think that there needs to be some pretty close auditing of this.
Yeah, I'm trying to figure out. You can't just pull up to the gas pump and have them take off the state gas tax. So do they have their own fuel supply on site, and like a farm would? And then they, when they have it delivered, they simply don't pay the gas tax then. And so they use it for farm purposes, and in this case, they'd be using it to fuel their vehicles.
Madam Chair, the way I understand it works is that they, of course, keep the receipts of their expenditures for fuel, and at the end of the year, they total those up. And, you know, like any tax return, you would have to have receipts to support the refund that you would be applying for, and send in that information.
Mr. Goodnow.
Madam Chair, Kevin Goodnow on behalf of the Minnesota Habilitation Coalition. Senator Gimsey covered exactly right. It's a gas tax refund. We're asking for to be able to apply for the gas tax refund in the future. So it's not an automatic, even though in the law it says exemption, the way to get the exemption is to go through the refund process. And so that's the same process they go through, and they do get audited on those returns. There are already in law certain health care providers, transporters, who already get this exemption and that are going to continue to get the exemption. This is an attempt to make sure that everybody's treated the same way, and for those that have been receiving it in the past, continue to receive it going forward. And for these providers, just about all their funds come from state or government funds, and it's a required part of the way they provide services. So it's required by the state they provide these services, including transportation.
Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, ambulances aren't exempt.
Senator Olson, I'm not sure if – I believe ambulances may be, but I'm not – positive, because that's this bill has nothing to do with that, so I can't answer that question.
In the current law, it looks like they are exempted.
Okay.
Are there other questions? I'm wondering about the overweight permits a little bit here. There's one for vehicles that are delivering farm products. And so there's going to be a new permit for that. Who would that be, like fertilizer companies, or who's going to be affected by that?
Well, it was attached to that. It's just trucks just having farm supplies.
Senator Gimsey?
Madam Chair,
Boyd, either way.
Maybe I'll have Ms. Berzovsky talk about this. This was a provision that was put on in Taxes Committee. Just a small additional enabling language for our farmers to do some what is, in essence, backhauling. What we were trying to do is have a provision that allows farmers from the field to go 100 miles in a special overweight situation, which is permitted, and then be able to do a backhaul and bring farm supplies back to the farm. So rather than having to come back from, say, a grain elevator or some other place, a terminal or something, and have to come back empty, what we would allow them to do is to bring back some fertilizer or some other farm product that they would use on the farm. So
Senator Gimsey, this bill does change the haul miles. Was it 50 or 75 miles? Is this the
50.
First 50? And now we're going to first 100 and allowing them to come back with a load that could be overweight?
Madam Chair and members, that is correct.
So is it a 10% overweight, or what is it?
Madam Chair, that is also correct.
Okay. I guess we're not a policy committee, but that's... This keeps getting pushed further and further, and sometimes I get a little concerned about that. But
Madam Chair, we had an extensive discussion about this in committee as far as the policy side of it and the implications to our highway system. But it is under the six-axle vehicle provision in there, which... with six axles and the additional tires, the weight is spread out more, and it is just a viable option, I think, for our farmers to make use of that return trip. There are some economic advantages, we believe, to expanding the distance and to allowing our farmers to do this backhaul type of provision. But
would you like to comment on this?
Sure, Madam Chair. Bruce Clavin, for the record, I represent the Minnesota Wheat Growers and others. I can shed some light for you here for your question. You have two separate issues. One is the 100 miles. That's on the first haul of a farm product. And that has to do with how the scale ticket is used in an overweight situation. I think your question was on the permit, and that would be on page 34, both starting at 34.8 and 34.21. This was the result of a MnDOT study from a few years ago, and it allows extra weight by permit. And when you do the math, and it's kind of third-grade napkin math when you look at the axle weights, at least in my example, but the six-axle vehicle can be purchased on a permit for $300 and the seven-axle vehicle for $500. And those can be used year-round at 97,000 pounds. Right now, it's limited to raw ag products. And so what will happen is someone will buy the permit. Let's take the seven-axle vehicle, and they'll haul corn from, say, the Litchfield Co-op into the port at Savage. And they haul 97,000 pounds. And it's actually better for the road because you have less weight on each axle. When they haul back, they can only bring 80,000 in that same truck because the permit doesn't allow them to go above 80 with something that's not a raw ag product. So the idea here was to allow a backhaul, as Senator Gimsey said, for farm supplies if they're hauling them back under the permitted load.
That went into the...
Okay, thank you. Are there any questions from members?
Offices on both sides.
Are there any other questions about the fiscal implications? Senator Gimsey, you have many, many provisions in here, and I don't think we have time to go through all of them. We have the summary here. Did members have a chance to go through this at all? And some of these bills we have heard in this committee already. Senator Cohen?
Well, Madam Chair, I've got a couple of questions. Can I ask them?
Certainly.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, Madam Chair, and Senator Gimsey, and I apologize, Madam Chair, because I was in Senator Perry's committee for the first part of the morning, so I don't know, because you indicated you'd heard this bill earlier today. Is that correct?
No, Senator Cohen. We have heard provisions in this bill, in this committee, separately, as separate bills.
So, Madam Chair.
Not all of them by any means.
Okay, so, Madam Chair, Senator Gimsey, let me ask about a couple of provisions. First of all, not so much a question, but I note Section 4 of the bill.
But I should find it, because that was kind of fun.
And I'm wondering if you'd like to comment for the record on Section 4.
Yes, Senator Gimsey.
Madam Chair, why am I not surprised it's in the bill? But
Madam Chair and Senator Cohen, I don't know if you have a specific question about that. Do you want me to kind of go through what the provisions
Madam Chair, and Senator Gimsey, I note that we have another shutdown provision in an omnibus bill. And I guess we've made the arguments and I'm sorry they've fallen on deaf ears, but we've made the arguments as to whether or not this is a good way to pass public policy. In court, Madam Chair, we might talk about a continuing objection to a certain line of questioning. So I guess I would note my continuing objection to the inclusion of these provisions in the omnibus bills. Let me ask a question about another section, Madam Chair, if I might, and that is, I think, Section, is it 67 that I caught?
Good
do I have the right? This is the public-private partnership.
What page is it on, Senator Cohen?
67.
There's no
67. So I changed sections.
54. Pardon? Page 54.
Yeah, page 54. I guess starting with section. There are several sections. But Madam Chair, Senator Gimsey, could you offer just some comments on why we should be doing this? Madam Chair, let me just indicate my concern. And I'd like to hear from Senator Gimsey relative to why this might be different. X number of years ago, I had some interest in some of these public-private kinds of partnerships where you'd ask some entity to take over some aspect of providing for public services. And then I kept on reading stories about how this was not a good idea and the kind of problems that took place, notably the corrections industry, where there were private prisons being run around the country, and what developed were just immense litigation problems where these private correctional facilities were doing all sorts of things, enjoined by the federal government, by a federal court, litigation on the part of inmates and so on. So I'm not suggesting this would be the same. But why would this work as opposed to other kinds of considerations? And for instance, I noticed some of the safety provisions in these sections where I think it reverts back to the state and so on. But let me present the hypothetical then. Some private entity takes over a public road and now it doesn't provide the upkeep. The road falls into disrepair. It becomes that much more expensive for the state to step in, handle the repair. How do we know that a private entity is going to provide road service and road quality at the level that folks in Minnesota would assume and expect?
Senator Gimsey.
Madam Chair and Senator Cohen, thank you for your questions. Again, this was a provision that was very well vetted out in our policy committee and a very good discussion about it. We created this pilot program, which is limited in scope to three projects, and also made it permissive on the part of the commissioner to engage in this. We've had significant discussions with the commissioner and others as far as innovative ways of financing projects, especially programs like the TED, Transportation for Economic Development, where we engage the business that business or businesses that are potentially benefited by road projects that would help them. We just wanted to extend this program and have a pilot program that we could monitor closely. Again, it's three projects, and just get at the end of the program, get some idea of how well it works, and get a report back on if we're making advancements. But it's just another tool in the toolbox, an innovative financing mechanism potentially in the future to promote economic development and to cost share specific road projects on our system.
But Madam Chair, Senator Gimsey, so what happens, though, with my hypothetical that a road operated by this private entity falls into disrepair? Now doesn't it become that much more expensive for the state to either take back the road or provide the repair that private entity didn't do properly in the first place?
Madam Chair and Senator Cohen, there is no envisioning that anybody other than MnDOT will take care of these roadways or the local units of government will take care of these roadways once they're completed. We're not talking about private entities taking over or maintaining any of these roadways.
Madam Chair, Senator Gimsey, let me just ask one other question about this section. Section 71 talks about funding from federal government, and this question might not be directed toward you. Maybe it might be directed toward Senator Hann as an example, as to why we can accept federal money for this but not for something like health care. What is the distinction?
Probably because we pay federal gas tax. I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know if Senator, it's a rhetorical question. If you want to respond, you can be otherwise.
Madam Chair, and I think it is a rhetorical question because it is attributing to me a view I don't hold. I've never once said that the state should not take federal dollars. They should take federal dollars where it's appropriate. And I think the issue that Senator Cohen is raising is the fact that I have said that I believe it's appropriate for the legislature to have oversight of federal dollars before they're spent by the administration. And I don't know that that equals the position that I'm being attributed to, that I would somehow suggest that we ought to refuse all federal money. I don't. I've never made that claim. And I don't know much about the federal funding for roads. But I certainly don't question, at least as far as the interstate commerce aspect is concerned, the use of roads to facilitate that, and the federal participation in that seems to me to be perfectly appropriate and constitutional, whereas I think there can be legitimate questions raised about federal participation in other things, such as health care, which, of course, we're having a huge debate going on at the Supreme Court this week on that very issue. So I guess I'm not – I know it's a rhetorical question on the part of Senator Cohen, so I guess I'm giving a rhetorical answer to that.
Well, Madam Chair,
Higgins.
Can I just very quickly?
If not on that issue.
Well, no, just to respond very quickly, Madam Chair, if I might. It was not meant to be rhetorical, and Senator Han, your response back was not rhetorical but was helpful. But I'll just comment, Madam Chair, with all the talk, and maybe not from this committee or our individuals on this committee, that might be unfair myself, but all the political rhetoric about the utilization of the federal government as when it's a good idea, a bad idea, I'd like to have someday. This is not directed toward, Madam Chair, yourself or members of the committee, but it sure might be helpful someday to get a sense of what the guidelines are as to when the utilization of federal money works or doesn't work.
We actually have several bills, and we're going to be putting them on the agenda, dealing with federal grants.
Okay.
And how we would accept them and approve them. Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair, and Senator Gimsey, on Section 67, the same public-private partnership that Senator Cohen was asking, I've never served on transportation. I have no idea what a BOT facility is or what a BTO facility is. And and on lines 31 and 32 of page 54, it looks like there's some interstate highway connection to this. I'm just confused about what exactly this is all about. And is a river crossing a bridge? And if a river crossing is a bridge, why don't we call it a bridge?
Senator Gimsey.
Well, Madam Chair, this is a specific project. Senator Peterson brought it to the committee along with this expanded authorization to move forward with this innovative approach. And let me answer your last question first. A river crossing, a bridge doesn't always cross just a river. A bridge can cross railroad tracks or another road, but that's probably why they used that language in here, that they will actually be crossing a river. On this route, Senator Peterson has worked with his local units of government and business sector in his district to come up with a unique approach to add additional lanes that would tie Highway 10 to Interstate 94, virtually using no state dollars to do it, just contributions on the part of the local partners, and it was very innovative and just another avenue to possibly, with the approval of the legislature and others, that once it's completed, then it will be turned over to our road authorities and the maintenance would be taken over. And that's where they talk about build, transfer, and operate, and BOT, which is build, operate, and transfer. Those provisions are in statute already, and it's just a way, a mechanism to complete a project and make sure that it's transferred to the proper authority. So this is just another way of looking at funding transportation. I think Senator Peterson's approach here has significant merit in that it could increase commerce for the St. Cloud area specifically in that region of the state and allow faster movement of freight. And you know, I think it's something that I certainly support as an approach to looking at things outside the box a bit. And I appreciated his bringing it forward.
So, Madam Chair and Senator Kimsey, did I understand you right that some of the businesses along here will actually be paying to build these extra lanes on our highway?
Senator Kimsey.
Chair and Senator Higgins, that's correct. And they will be supporting some of the borrowing that through their own funds and through this mechanism that they have. I don't know exactly what to call it, but it's still somewhat it's still in the works. But they have an understanding there that they will support the financing for this additional four-lane piece of highway that will connect those two major highways.
Madam Chair, Senator just Higgins? One more question. How many miles of highway are we talking here? I'm trying to remember where 94 and 10 connect or get close to each other.
Madam Chair, a
couple miles?
Senator Higgins, I want to say, I don't know if MnDOT.
The 24, yeah, that's right through St. Cloud.
I'm getting indications that it's roughly 5 miles, but this is really the closest point where 10 and 94, one of the closer points where 10 and 94 kind of parallel one another.
Yeah.
And this would be just a four-lane highway.
The east side ones on the west side of St. Cloud.
Connect the two,
yeah,
giving an alternate route to a lot of traffic and trucks. So.
Thank you. I know that Commissioner Sorrell is looking for public-private partnership opportunities and has talked about that in the past. On page 54, line 27, I think we need to consider a little amendment where it says mechanisms the commissioner may consider include. Could we say the commissioner may consider mechanisms that include? So we'd move the mechanism out and place it after consider, and that would also have it that with it, mechanisms that. So the commissioner may consider mechanisms that include but are not limited to. You want to make that motion? Senator Higgins makes that motion for a clarifying amendment. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. The amendment does prevail, and it is adopted. Are there any other questions?
Madam Chair, as long as we are doing some amendments, could we have some cleanup amendments that we would like to have somebody introduce and discuss here so that our language conforms with bills that are either making their way separately or the House version of this bill?
Okay. If those could be distributed.
Madam Chair, we have the A-15, the A-16, and the A-19 amendments.
We'll start with the A-15 amendment. It's on page 41. Senator Gimsey, do you want to explain that amendment?
Madam Chair, I'll have Ms. Berezovsky. It's technical in nature. I'll have her.
Ms. Berezovsky.
Madam Chair and members, the A-15 is a technical amendment. Lines 1.2 to 1.4 simply rearrange the order of words as suggested by the Department of Revenue for clarity and consistency. And on 1.5, that was an error. We intended to make a motor vehicle sales tax exemption for mobile medical units prospective. It had originally been retroactive, and
the it was changed to being prospective, so we're just cleaning up that date to make to give it prospective application.
Are there any questions about the amendment? If not, Senator Olson moves that the A15 amendment be recommended to pass.
Madam Chair.
Senator Higgins.
On line, where am I here? Never mind. Sorry. It's looking on the wrong page. You don't engross very well when it's on the wrong page.
On the A15 amendment on Senator Olson's motion, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. The motion does prevail. The amendment is adopted. And then we will take the next one. Is on page 3 of the bill.
Madam Chair.
Senator Gimsey.
The A16 amendment also is a technical amendment that just changes some wording so that the language that is in our bill also conforms to the language of the bill that was passed off the Senate floor yesterday. And the language changes here don't change the meaning at all in the bill.
Are there any questions about the A16 amendment? Senator Olson moves the A16 amendment on that motion. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, nay. The motion does prevail. The amendment is adopted. And I believe we have one more.
Madam Chair and members, the A19 amendment is one that you probably will recognize from recent history. It's the amendment that you just added to Senator Hoffman's bill. And this, is, again, is just language that we want our bill to be in sync, if you will, with Senator Hoffman's motorcycle safety guard bill.
Senator Magnus moves the A19 amendment. Is there any discussion? If not, all in favor, Senator Cohen.
So, Madam Chair, Senator Gimsey, are we adding all of Senator Hoffman's bill to?
It's already in there.
It's already there.
Senator Gimsey.
Madam Chair and Senator Cohen, it's in our omnibus. Senator Hoffman's bill is in our omnibus bill, and what we would like to do is
the two sections.
In section 32 and 51, and we just are trying to make sure that the language in our bill conforms with their language.
Madam Chair.
Senator Cohen.
Can I ask another rhetorical question?
Yes.
Madam Chair, why do you adopt all of our bad habits, but none of our good habits?
Did you have some good habits, Senator Cohen?
Rhetorical question.
On the A19 amendment, we've already had discussion on this and understand the purpose for it. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. The motion does prevail. The amendment is adopted.
Madam Chair.
Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair, when we were on page 3, section 3 jumped out at me for a couple of different things. Trunk Highway 14 is also known as Legislative Route Number 7, which why do we have legislative routes on highways? But what's the significance of the black and yellow trail?
Senator Gimsey?
Are we missing our history? Yeah, what are we missing in our history?
That is an interesting name for a road.
Yeah.
Who brought that one?
Madam Chair and Senator
Gimsey?
Higgins. This is an effort to add Minnesota to an already existing named trailway, the black and white trail that extends from that extends all the way from Chicago to St. Louis. And there's a gap in that. Senator Senjum ask that we designate that.
Huh? Chicago to St. Louis does not go through Minnesota.
To the Black Hills. I'm confused.
What's the significance of the term, the black and yellow? Is it? What?
Madam Chair and Senator Higgins, the way I understand it, it has some historical significance that goes back to the early days of making roads in our country or creating roads in our country, and it's just a designation continuation.
Senator Gimsey, I'm going to ask you again on the floor, so would you find out? Because Senator Olson and I are both wondering what we don't know about history.
Madam Chair and Senator Higgins, I'm Gimsey. Sure Senator Senjum will be there to be quite helpful in helping to us all understand it. But my understanding is that what this will do is actually, besides the language, there will be two signs that will be put up, one on either border of the state of Minnesota on Highway 14, simply just to designate it. But.
And then, Madam Chair, legislative route number 7.
That's an old one. Ms. Berezovsky, do you have any history on that?
Madam Chair, I don't have any history of it, but our state constitution requires that the trunk highway system be established by law. So the entire trunk highway system is set out in statute, and it's divided into legislative routes that are all numbered consecutively. Yeah. So normally,
things I don't know.
When we refer to a trunk highway, because it is going into statute, we also reference the legislative route number.
I'll be darned. Thank you.
Is there anyone who wants to testify for or against the bill? Any other questions from members? I thought maybe that black and yellow had something to do with part of it was paved and part of it was like the sandstone gravel, which was the yellow. So
the Bumblebee Trail.
The Bumblebee Trail. If there's no other questions, Senator Magnus?
Madam Chair, I'll move Senate File 2321.
Senate
to the floor.
Senator Magnus moves Senate File 2321 as amended, be recommended to pass and to be placed on general orders. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, nay. The motion does prevail. The bill will be placed on general orders. And members, we were sitting here debating whether or not we should move up our schedule till 8 o'clock tomorrow.
No.
But then we need members to be here at 8:30. We really got started a half hour late today, but we did have a lot of other committees going on, and I don't expect that to happen tomorrow. So, but members, we have a full agenda tomorrow, and otherwise we'll have to go after session tomorrow evening. So if we can be here at 8:30, we'll be in good shape. Meeting is adjourned.